the Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources, and thank everybody for being here. As I said to people just before, a little earlier, we are going to arrange the order a little differently. We're going to start out with 2617, as we had said, then we're going to move to the work sessions on three bills, then we're going to come back to the public hearing on 2295. So with that, I will open a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2617, and I'll have our administrator give a short explanation, and then Mr. Holby, if you want to come up, you can be tabled.
Thank you, Chair. Just briefly, House Bill 2617 does authorize the Department of Agriculture to issue license for temporary use of food establishments for persons renting or leasing establishments, and then creates a penalty for violation. We do have the dash three amendments in front of you. I will defer to Representative Holby to perhaps explain these in more detail, and this does not have a substantive referral on it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. For the record, Paul Holby, State Representative from District 8, and I'm sure this is the first of a few great bills you'll be seeing from me in this committee. We really want to thank you for hearing House Bill 2617. This bill really came to me from a constituent issue, and this is really simply about helping out small business. Yeah, when it comes to our agricultural products in this state, I guess simply put, you know, this bill is enabling small business farmers or ranchers and now dairymen and a whole host of others, as this bill's gotten a little bit larger since I first introduced it, to basically package their products and put their own label on it to enable them to market themselves and to market their homegrown products to the community and to the state of Oregon. Currently, under our licensing laws, they're not able to do that, frankly, and this bill basically just allows these folks to become licensed at an existing establishment that already has a license as an additional licensee, simply put. And there's a lot of technical pieces about this bill, and the Department of Agriculture is here to walk you through any of the technicalities of it. My knowledge of this is just pretty basic, pretty common sense. It seemed like a problem for my constituent, and as I found out, I found a few other people that were interested in this same concept, because a lot of our agricultural community is small business, and how do we help them out? And you know, it really seemed like a common sense thing to do to let them market their own label if they're able to go to the expense and the effort to package their own product and find a licensee that they will cooperate with them to do that. Simply put, that's it. And I really got to thank Ron McKay, the Department of Agriculture, for recognizing this issue and thinking about it. And we solved it once, and then they thought about it again and thought we could expand this to other parts of the agricultural community and solved it twice. And looked at it a third time and made it even a better bill. So that's why you're looking at the dash three amendment. I think it's ready to go as is. Haven't heard any complaints from anybody. I think the Farm Bureau, although I haven't heard from them officially, but have talked to them. They like this bill. And I'm just really happy I was able to bring this bill to your committee.
Thank you. Any questions? Yes, Representative Plum.
Well, actually, I think now in the dash threes we would have, let's see, do we have, yeah, okay, custom slaughtering establishment. That answered my question. Just so you know, I think it's so great that this bill's here. I went to a small farms conference in Corvallis one weekend in February, and somebody talked to me about something like this, and I was thinking, darn it, I think I'd missed the deadline on bills. I didn't know this was coming, and I was thinking, well, maybe next session we'll find a way to help, you know, the little guy be able to go and use a facility, and I'm just so pleased to see it. It's a wonderful idea.
Yeah, and frankly, the constituent of mine, I don't even know if he's here today. He's probably not, but he's an organic pig farmer, and if you like pork, you know, He puts out an excellent product, and you know it's he's very well known in our community, and it's just a shame he couldn't put his own label on his product to help promote his business locally. So that was sort of the genesis of this bill.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, Mr. Chair, I just want you to know that pigs are under the open range law.
Yeah. No, they're not under the open range.
That's right.
They're excluded.
That's right. You cannot have them. They're like buffalo.
They're
now.
Like buffalo. They have a partner now that can't be out there in the range.
But I do encourage the Department of Agriculture to come up and maybe give you a little more thorough explanation of how this bill's been expanded to probably affect a lot more of the agricultural community and really make a lot of opportunities out there for small business.
I want to also say that I think, you know, we've done some Brand Oregon stuff in our state. This extends that and makes some more opportunities for people within the state to do their own brand stuff, which I think is really a good thing. And I hope that this covers all the things that need it to cover. We'll find out when someone out there says, hey, it doesn't work for mine. I need to get into this thing. So
well,
I'm
not saying that it perhaps covers everybody,
right.
But certainly the Department of Agriculture has open ears on the Senate side as well as they do here on the House, and I just encourage you to move this bill along so it gets through the process. I think it's a really important piece for a lot of folks out there.
Thank you.
So thank you.
I'll have Ron McKay from Agriculture coming up.
Chair Roland, members of the committee, I'm Ron McKay, the administrator of the Food Safety Division at the Department of Agriculture. House Bill 2617 allows or authorizes the Department of Agriculture to license more than one person at a single facility. Currently, the way the statute is written, we can only license one person. In the past, we've had a number of situations where more than one individual, and these are usually small businesses, approach us and want to be licensed at a facility that already has a license, and we're not able to do that. As Representative Holvey alluded to just a minute ago, we had a situation with a small processor that wanted to start up down in the Eugene area. He wanted to make a meat product in an establishment that was already licensed. We were not able to issue a license to him in that facility. The only thing that we could do is allow him to operate under the first person's license. The problem was he wanted to put his own name on the product. The USDA said you can't put your name on the product unless you have a license. So we kind of appeared like we ganged up on him and stopped him at doing this. So when conditions are appropriate or acceptable, House Bill 2617 will allow us to license multiple people at a single location. The department supports the bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
What is the current situation for, I mean, I'm kind of looking at the list, and is this bill even needed for someone who, like, wants to take, say you got a berry grower, and they want to turn it into some sort of jam or salsa, but they don't have a license, and they use, like, the community college's commercial kitchen or something like that to do it. How does something like that work, and would this help?
Yes, Representative Robin, Representative Clem, if a person wanted to make a product like a jam, they would need to have a food processing license.
Mm-hmm.
If the community kitchen already had a license, then they would do what I said earlier. They would have to operate under the existing license. We have this situation going on at Oregon State University. They have a pilot plant there where they have a fairly large number of people making products in that pilot plant all under one license. Oregon State University is responsible mm-hmm. for all of the persons there. So this would allow each one of them to operate separately, to use their name, to be licensed. So.
And just to follow up on the construction of the bill, does this allow for berries and, you know, is this, I mean, cherries, grapes, is this specific or does it kind of say just period?
Yes. Representative Clem, we, at Representative Holtz's permission, we expanded this to apply to bakeries, food processors, meat processors, and dairy. So that it applies to all the statutes that we have. So it would allow that for the situation you're referring to or pretty much anything else that we license.
Under the food process.
Under the food
process. Oh, great. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Yes, Representative
McPherson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McKenna, it's a very attractive idea, and I guess the only question I'd ask you is there anything about the branding and the single licensee structure that makes it better for protecting the public safety from tainted food? That is, if you've got an outbreak of some kind of problem like the problems that the California spinach had or something, would this make it more difficult to identify what the source of the contamination is and take remedial action?
Chair Roblin, Representative McPherson, I think this would help the department better recall product or get a handle on an outbreak, in that each and every individual that was at a location would have a license. Therefore, we would have a record of that in our files, so that if there were five businesses, for instance, operating from a single location, each one of those five businesses would be licensed. We would have records that indicate what they produced. If a recall were to happen, we would know where that firm was. We would have a history on it. Whereas currently, we only have a file on the first business that was there, the first business that was licensed. So it could leave some gaps.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. You're welcome. Any other questions?
Good bill should pass.
Okay. Thanks. Oh, yeah, that's a good question. We don't have a fiscal on this right now. Do you see this as costing any extra money with regard to the department?
Yes, sir.
Or receiving extra money.
There will be some cost to some small processors that are currently able to operate under the first license, or the initial licensee. We estimate, and that's what it is, somewhere between 20 and 40 firms per year would fit under this. So those firms would fit in the license fee categories that we currently have set up. Those are set up based on gross annual sales and the time that we spend, the historical time we've spent in that industry. So we have license fees that are divided into six categories, from the smallest to those that are doing in excess of $10 million. So there would be a cost to some small businesses.
How about to the state and your department?
No, sir, I don't believe there would be any additional cost there. We're currently making the inspections.
Actually, yep, Gina, I have a question. As I read it, it's may issue. Could businesses continue to operate under the structure they have today?
Representative Roblin, Representative Maurer, yes, sir, they could operate this way if the original licensee authorized that.
Right.
It is not the direction we would like to go, and probably through a rulemaking is to make this so that each of the businesses would set up this way.
Would you allow a transition period so that businesses had several or a number of years to transition out of their current status to the new status to minimize that impact?
Representative Maurer, we're just going into our licensing period. In fact, the 1st of July is our licensing period, so there would be another one-year period before this would happen, which would give us time to visit with the firms and inform them of what this bill would do, or has done if it passes, to give them a year's transition period.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the -3 amendments to House Bill 26.
We're in a public hearing.
Oh, well,
we'll get there in a second.
Sorry, I thought that's
what that's
I
okay. Right. And we've got one more person to testify.
See, Brian.
See, B-squared, you're taking the lead here.
Brian, sir.
Thank you very much. And we have Katie Fass.
We just wanted
from the Farm Bureau. We brought Fass here because we knew we were in that kind of a removal. Okay, so we got Fass here now.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I am a little nervous to say anything. I might screw it up. Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. The Eugene farmer that's been referenced is a member of mine, Sweetbriar Farms, and he had called me during the interim with this conflict that he was in. We met with the department, and after a meeting with Ron McKay and others, we saw that, unfortunately, a resolution was not available except for bringing a bill to the legislature, and I appreciate Representative Holvey working with his constituent and bringing this much-needed piece of legislation forward as the agricultural industry looks at value-added options to increase their profitability for small operators. We need to be able to make sure that the food safety laws allow them to have a safe product, but at the same time not have to go to that capital expense to have their own operation that's under 100% of their control. And that's the situation this gentleman's in. He's a farmer and a meat cutter, but at the same time, he can't at this time go to the expense to have his own facility and have the meat cutting equipment as well. He also is able to hire or contract with the company to use some of those employees to cut his meat and help him with the processing. So we ask for your support of this bill. It's a good bill to make some minor tweak, but it has a big impact for some small producers.
Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close our public hearing on 2617, and we're going to open a work session on 2617. Representative Clem.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I move the -3 amendments to House Bill 2617.
Representative Clem has moved the -3 amendments to House Bill 2617. Is there any discussion?
Good bill should pass.
Any, does everybody approve of the amendments? Seeing no problems, the amendments are passed. Yes,
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2617 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Clem has moved House Bill 2617 as amended to the House with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Seeing none, we will have a roll call by our committee assistant.
Representative Boakley?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Excused.
And Chair Roblin?
Aye. Bill passes. Now the question is this a consent calendar?
Mr. Chair, I would agree, except that I can foresee several members asking the exact same question Representative Maurer asked, and I can see several of our counselors and legal types asking exactly the liability issue as we're splitting liability. So
it will assign Representative Holvey to carry this bill.
Great idea, Mr. Chair. Okay. That we don't have to do it.
It's a still.
Thank you very much. We'll close our work session on 2617, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 3188. This is one, and we can have, I think Dagami is here. If we have any questions for him, we had some questions at the end of the last one on this bill.
Mr. Chair, he's not one of the people we cut today?
Fred? Yeah. So, any questions?
Such a task to represent him.
A 12% cut.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we could ask that question.
Right. I was going to do a remonstrative, but we all want to get off the floor.
So, when we had this bill last, I think there were some questions that people had had regarding. And I guess I'll have you come on up just for a second. One of the questions was there was a number of people who were a little concerned at one time with respect to the raising the fees. And I just want to make sure that we have talked with the industry and they have approved these fees. Is that your understanding? I mean, they appreciate these?
Chair Roman Gary, for the record, Gary Lynch, Assistant Director, Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and I have letters from the only three producers in the state, all supporting not only the fee increases in the bill, but those that were changed effectively in the -1 amendment.
We're in a work session.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 30. There's no referral.
Pardon?
No referral.
I think we it's.
Mr. Chair, we do have a letter.
Is it rescinded?
Yeah, we do, and we do have -1 amendments, and we do have then a letter to rescind the referral to Ways and Means.
So it goes to Ways and Means.
No,
but
we
rescind it.
We just passed the budget.
Yes.
And we do have a -1 amendment.
We do have a -1 amendment.
I can do the script if you want. They can put all the rescension and all that stuff.
Representative Clem.
Mr. Chair,
moving quick enough.
I know, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3188.
Representative Clem has moved the dash one amendments to 3188. Any discussion? Anybody in opposition? Seeing none, the amendments pass.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3188 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and if the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Clem has moved the House Bill 3188 as amended to the House with a due pass recommendation and also that they rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. So, any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote from Mr. Penn.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Inkelman?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Bauer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Excuse.
Representative Gopas?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Bill passes.
This is your bill, Mr. Chair.
Oh,
your name is right on it here.
I know, it's true. I will carry this one. Next, we have okay, we'll close the work session on 3188 and open the work session on 3494. Again, this is one we heard earlier.
We do have a dash one amendments.
We do have a dash one amendments for this one as well. This one was the one that has the Department of Agriculture receiving grants. Did you get your questions answered, Representative Boquist?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, on behalf of other members, I did ask those questions, and I did get those answered, and I'd be happy to carry this when we get done with it, because I know they're going to ask questions about it.
Okay. So do I have a motion, Representative Clem?
You do. Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3494.
Representative Clem has moved the dash one amendments to 3494. Any discussion? Any opposition to those? The amendments have passed. Representative Clem.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3494 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Clem has moved House Bill 3494 with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call by our assistant.
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Malice?
Aye.
Representative Smith? Excuse. Representative
Gopas?
Aye.
Representative
Clinton?
Aye.
Chair
Roblin? Aye. And we will have Representative
Boquist
carry the bill.
I'd be delighted to, unless I'll check with Representative Krueger since this is the only state, I'll be delighted to carry it.
Okay. So we better close the work session on 3494. And next, we'll have a open a work session on House Bill 3164. This one we had a hearing on a while back. It has to. Oh, and we did get a rescission of the Ways and Means referral on this bill. This has to do with asking that as we for hunting and wildlife, no net loss. Is that this one?
It is.
Yeah. No revenue impact, no other impacts. So, discussions on this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I will be voting no on this bill.
Okay.
I don't feel that it's necessary, and I sort of feel like it's a problem, I mean, a solution in search of a problem. And when I didn't hear compelling testimony that said to me that we needed to have this in statute, so I'll be a no.
Okay. Thank you, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, I'll be a yes because I have heard compelling evidence, and I heard it last time too. So,
and Mr. Chair, I'll be a no on this bill as well. I mean, we have sort of a general decline in the interest in hunting among Oregonians, as purported to us by people who are in the activity and people in the agency, and so a no net loss of habit of hunting areas doesn't seem like it squares up with where the public is headed in terms of how they use those lands.
Okay. Representative Clem.
I wanted to be compelling the other day, but I know that I...
Sorry.
It's okay.
Representative.
Yes. B-squared all support you, don't worry.
Thank you. Just so we have for the record, there is definitely the assertion out there, in the, at least the hunting side of the community, that part of the interest is unavailability of land, and it's so frustrating when you attempt to go hunting. So there may be others, obviously, who aren't interested in for other reasons, but there are lots of hunters who accessible land is what drives the interest, and as other lands become inaccessible, you might report, I'm not buying a tag, so the tags go down, but it's out of frustration, not so much out of, you know, lack of interest in the activity.
And I think it's one, I'm just going to make my comment, is that, you know, from my perspective, I think that our public lands are a real wonderful thing that we have here in Oregon, and that multiple uses of those public lands are very important to all of our citizens. And what happens is that we're having more and more of our private lands that are taken off. We're losing some of our forest lands, we're losing some of our farmlands to other investments and other kinds of things, and which is frustrating to me as well. But in doing so, oftentimes hunting places and other things become less and less accessible, and the public lands are where those big open spaces are that make it available for people. So I think that keeping this in mind and working with it and letting the department work as they move things around and make places off limits and other places on limits is a good public policy from my perspective. So I appreciate all the other people, and I thank you. But with that, any other discussion? Let's have a... Did we do the...
Need a motion.
We need a motion. Yeah.
Happily. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3164 to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Clam has moved House Bill 3164 to the House with the due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. With that, any other discussion? Hearing none, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative McPherson?
No.
Representative Maurer?
Yes.
Representative Smith, excuse. Representative Boquist?
Aye.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder?
No.
Chair Robler?
Aye. Bill passes. Did you want to carry this one? Or not?
Sure. Yes. Yeah, please.
Oh, okay.
Look, I just took the other one. It's your turn to take one, right?
We will.
You did make the motion, after all.
What's that?
You really want to carry it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. As long as my constituent Laurel isn't furious with me, but we talked about it, I think we're okay. But
okay. We will close our work session on 3164. And we're going to have a little bit more time if we need it for our other hearing. So you guys are very efficient. I appreciate the work.
I'm still working on island annexation stuff this afternoon, so I'll have a little bit more time.
Okay.
Yeah, that's true.
So now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2295, and we'll have a short description by our administrator, and at that time, after that, we'll have the department.
Thank you, Chair. This bill, 2295, does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. What the bill does is it does define gray wolf as a game mammal. It directs State Fish Wildlife Commission to establish special management regulations for the gray wolf, describes circumstances in which wolf may be taken, and then directs the commission to establish wolf accreditation compensation and cost-sharing programs to compensate people who suffer loss or injury due to wolf accreditation. Creates a management compensation proactive trust fund, directs the commission to create an advisory committee for screening claims and develop a method for resolving compensation claims. Thank you.
Thank you. So, Rep. Come on up. Did they even sign up? Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, Al's not here. Yeah. This must be Elkins and Wiley.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for being here.
You bet. For the record, my name is Roy Elliker. I am the Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, in charge of Fish and Wildlife Programs. And on my left, Mr. Russ Morgan. He is Oregon State Wolf Coordinator and biologist, and essentially our program leader on wolf issues in Oregon, based in La Grande. Wanted to make a brief statement, and you have in front of us our written statement, and Russ and I want to kind of go over that with you. I know there's people here, other to testify, and we'll be brief, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for the opportunity here. In response to federal wolf introduction efforts in neighboring states, in 2002, ODFW and the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission undertook an extensive public process over the last 2.5 years, 15 town hall meetings, and 6,000 public comments later, to come with Oregon's wolf conservation management plan. The plan itself was based on 14 months of discussion, negotiation, and advice to the commission by a 14-member wolf advisory committee made up of landowners, hunters, ranchers, biologists, and others. It has resulted in what some biologists or some wildlife officials around the West saying is one of the finest wolf plans, I guess, in North America as far as its scope and extent. It's a very lengthy document adopted in February 2005. I guess the short of it is this, and this plan is not a plan of wolf introduction or reintroduction to Oregon, nor a plan of wolf eradication in Oregon, but it's designed to deal with what is happening because of federal wolf introduction efforts in other states, particularly neighboring states to the east, particularly Idaho. Those have been fairly successful efforts. Over the past 10 years in Idaho alone, not looking at Montana or Utah, and we're not talking about wolves from Michigan, Minnesota, or Wisconsin, but in Idaho alone, over the past 10 years, those federal efforts have resulted in now the establishment of 76 packs of wolves in Idaho, over 670 wolves at last count there. Very prolific. And there are also now verified wolf reports from Eastern Washington. Upon questioning, and when you talk to Russ in a few minutes, you'll see that we have quite a few reports come in to us that we try and establish whether we confirm or not. Right now, we don't have any confirmed wolves in Oregon as we speak, but there's certainly lots of anecdotal sightings and evidence that there are some wolves at least passing through eastern Oregon at times. But anyway, so I guess if there's a few things uncertain, I've heard of a death and taxes. I guess at the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, we feel fairly certain that there will be wolves in Oregon, and that will be sooner rather than later based on what's going on around us. Anyway, this bill today, 2295, represents the best efforts of the department under the guidance of the wolf plan to provide landowners additional tools to help them cope with wolf issues as wolves end up returning to Oregon. This bill represents, 2295 represents where we ended up at last session when a wolf bill was introduced, which we had a great hand in. It wasn't our bill, but we had quite a hand in that introduction. Thanks, Representative Greg Smith. But this bill represents where, at least from the department's efforts, where many of the groups, not all, but many of the groups felt at least there was some consensus and some agreement on these 4 points that Russ is going to talk about in a second. So the bill does differ from what was introduced last session, but again, it is under the guidance of the Wolf Plan and Commission and follows the guidance provided by the Commission to the department at that time. To fully implement the Wolf Plan, there are 4 main changes to existing Oregon wildlife law that this bill would change. And I'll let Russ talk about exactly those 4 changes the bill calls for.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Russ Morgan. I'm the state wolf coordinator for ODFW. The 4 provisions of the bill, the 4 main provisions of the bill, I'll go over them one by one. The first is it establishes a state-run compensation and a proactive trust fund for wolf-related losses and to prevent wolf-related losses. Wolf-related losses are a big issue to us. Compensation specifically for wolf-related losses, livestock losses, working dog losses, sporting dog losses, has been shown to be an effective tool in helping promote tolerance for wolves, which in turn promotes conservation. And I think we're in a fortunate position to have learned from a number of other states, and we are utilizing some of that information to our benefit. In addition to compensating livestock producers for the loss of livestock, working dogs, sporting dogs, we believe that the proactive portion of the bill is extremely important to help prevent depredations in the first place. Again, the program, as you see written here, is patterned after a number of other existing and successful wolf depredation programs across the country. The second provision, amending the wildlife damage statute, this amendment is simple. It is designed to allow additional flexibility for livestock producers to protect their livestock. What it does is it allows a livestock producer, assuming federal delisting, and I want to make that clear, it allows a livestock producer to lethally take a wolf if they catch it attacking their livestock, and they can do so without a permit. Under current rule, a livestock producer would have to first obtain a permit from the department to do so, again, assuming federal delisting. And that permit could be given only under certain circumstances. Number one, that there was a previous depredation, and methods, number two, methods to resolve that are deemed ineffective. So this does simplify and provide flexibility in that aspect. The third provision adds gray wolf to the definition of game mammal. At some point in the future, as Oregon's wolves come and increase, and we go from what we refer to as the conservation phase of the Oregon Wolf Plan to the management phase, having the ability to have management tools will be important. Tools such as controlled hunting, controlled trapping. Now, I would suggest that the Oregon Wolf Plan makes it very clear that how we would implement controlled hunting, controlled trapping are very clearly and specifically defined, and the circumstances that we use those in are clearly defined in the Wolf Plan. So they are special management regulations. This would help us address livestock depredation issues. I also might add that it will allow us the ability to use existing game laws in many cases and not have to reinvent new, as we start into controlled hunting, to reinvent new regulations. We can use existing game regulations, simple things such as shooting hours or the unlawful to hunt a game animal from an aircraft, those types of things. The final point or provision of the bill is allowing the commission to issue incidental take permits in certain circumstances. Currently, the Oregon Endangered Species Act prohibits the commission from issuing incidental take permit if in this case the gray wolf, is federally listed. For example, if the federal government were to downlist from endangered status to threatened status, that may, by federal law, allow incidental take permits to be issued. However, current Oregon law would not allow that. We're trying to match those up a little better. A case where this could be used, if an area is known to have wolves and there is trapping occurring for other species, such as coyotes, on livestock damage situations, it would give the department the ability to work specifically with an operator and set guidance through the incidental take permit process so that we could help prevent the taking of wolves, as well as legally, they would be more legally covered. I'll kind of summarize and close up. As Roy stated earlier, the department expects there to be a breeding population of wolves in Oregon, and likely sooner than later. If we look at other states, we see that some level of conflict can be expected. Some level of conflict between livestock, humans, and wolves can be expected. This bill is really designed to be an effective method for responsible management, while at the same time we provide for the conservation and long-term conservation of wolves. With that, I will say we support the adoption of House Bill 2295.
Questions? Representative Boakley.
Mr. Chair, I just want to just clarify, and I apologize for stepping out from last session. Items 2, 3, and 4, portions of the bill, amending ORS regarding wildlife damage, definition of game mammal, and incidental take. I guess my question, just to clarify, is at some point, in order to comply with future ESA or downlistings, uplistings, whatever else, those are the three technical changes we need to make. Is that not correct?
Representative Boquist, Chair Roblin. That is correct. Those are existing statutes that we are recommending change to, yes.
Well, as a follow-up, more specifically, for us at some future point to comply with the ESA and the downlisting, several of these technical changes have to be made to show good faith to the federal government, I believe.
Representative Boquist, I think Oregon has put together through the Wolf planning process a plan that addresses many of the concerns of the federal government. We have not received formal approval of our plan through the federal government. However, these provisions as related to amending wildlife damage, allowing lethal take in certain situations, these are being used in other areas and they seem to be looked upon favorably.
One thing, Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist, I want to be clear, what I heard you ask is that these changes were needed to allow us to kind of mesh with any federal delisting efforts, and I guess whether or not this bill passes through the legislature, signed by the governor or not, I think the federal, the Fish and Wildlife Service in particular, have their own agenda and own issues, and they will be proceeding ahead whether or not this bill passes or not. The bill does, again, provide some good landowner tools and simplify some issues for us here in Oregon law that, once they are federally delisted, which could be fairly shortly if the Fish and Wildlife Service has its way, then these are key.
Very following, Mr. Chair. And more of a comment, just for the committee members who are here, is you know, we spent God knows how long on this last time, Oregon and Hoover. But, I mean, these three components of the law that if we implement those, give us better chances and better management tools in the future, and actually kind of sets, at least was sold to us, and there's some rationale, that it sets a good precedence in letting the feds know that we're serious about the plan, so on and so forth, even those who opposed it, like me.
And questions?
I did know.
Representative Quinn?
This is just, some of this is new to me. So there's the Federal Endangered Species Act that we're sort of talking about as the trigger. While the gray wolf is listed by the federal government as endangered or threatened species, do we also have a state listing? So if it's threatened federally, but there's a large population in another state, and they then move it off that list, but there's a smaller population here, you know, are we also looking at that, or how does that work?
Representative Clem, Chair Roblin. This provision is dealing specifically with state ESA. Oh. It is not always easy to keep the two separate. Currently, they are federally endangered, but there is a federal proposal at hand to delist, at least in a portion of Oregon. However, this is dealing with not necessarily delisting, but potential downlisting. That's not even proposed. It's not on the playing field at this time. But the ability or the amendment here is to authorize through state law the ability to issue incidental take permits. At the same time, I should make it clear that that's only if it's allowed by the federal government. Right now, if you asked, is it allowed? Could we do that right now? And the answer is no. We could not issue incidental take permits in Oregon, even if it was passed. This was passed, and it was still federally listed. So,
additionally, Chair Roblin, Representative Clem, if I could, there is, yes, a State Endangered Species Act. The wolves are listed as endangered on the State Endangered Species Act, and that came about by legislative fiat, in a sense. When the state ESA was created, there was a list of animals that were brought over from the federal list, mm-hmm. and automatically made a part of the state list, and wolves were on that list originally, which is why gray wolves are listed as endangered under the State Endangered Species Act here. The wolf plan itself is essentially part of it, is partly designed as a recovery plan, which is needed under the state ESA to remove them off the state ESA list when a certain number of them become established in certain areas around the state. So the wolf plan is designed both as a recovery plan to get them off the state list when they arrive, as well as a management plan when now they're off the state list and, of course, the federal list, and now we're managing these animals. And like I think Russ has summed up, when wolves are present, there are usually other conflicts that arise. It's just that kind of mammal or game animal, and so in every place that there are wolves, there are some conflicts, and they have to be managed.
And
I just to make sure, because I thought at one point I heard the federal and state thing mixed up again. But so these incidental take permits, federally, you couldn't do it now anyway, as you mentioned. So once it gets federally delisted, but the population isn't large enough in Oregon to meet the Oregon delisting standards, still no incidental take permits. It's just after it's already off the Oregon one, or is it it's off the feds, but not necessarily off the Oregon?
Representative Roman, Representative Clem, I'm sorry, Chair Roman, it was that last one you just said.
Okay.
When it's off the federal list, but not quite enough to be off the state list, that's when the incidental take permit would be very useful. In case somebody traps one, like somebody trapping coyotes around sheep or something and accidentally catches a wolf.
Correct. That's correct. While it is state listed.
Yep. And in the plan, and if you don't have copies of the plan, you'd like one, we could get you one.
Oh, absolutely.
We've got some.
It definitely, our plan is about our PSA, and it says you have to have X number of breeding pairs before it will be delisted in the state of Oregon. So the federal government overrides everybody. Once they start doing things, then the state ESA takes effect until we meet its requirements. Once those requirements are met, then most of this would be usable. Until then, it isn't. That makes sense to people. And the other part that you didn't ask, and this would be the first case in Oregon on your group one where you do actually have a proactive compensation plan, correct?
Chair Roblin, that's correct.
Chair Roblin, that's correct.
Mr. Chair, I didn't ask because I don't even consider that part of the options. But as a follow-up, Mr. Chair, just for the members of the board here, I mean, the key issue here after months of this last time around and even during the interim here is that these number two, three, and four items provide the tools that then allow later for us to do downlisting and management of the species at a state level versus a federal level. And the whole goal here is, even though it doesn't do anything today, it provides the tools in place, and obviously the people that are above that are looking at downlisting, delisting, so on and so forth, then look down at the state and say, do you have the tools in place to manage it? Because we're going up, and we've asked several times, why don't you let us manage it, since they don't suppose any of them here yet, so why don't we get to manage it, which is a whole other story. But these are just the tools. I mean, the legislature was last asked time to put these in, but we didn't have the wolf plan, and there was all kinds of other things, and I'm adamantly opposed to the wolf plan, but now it's a fact of life, so we just kind of need to get on with life. And I'll accept portion one, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Which is compensation.
The other question that I would have you answer, if you can. In our plan, it's like eight packs or eight breeding pairs before we're...
Chair Roblin, are you referring to at the point at which we delist?
Yes.
It is four breeding pairs
for
three consecutive years on either side of the state.
Okay.
East side or west side?
Both sides of the state, Madam Chair.
So if they're on one side or the other side, if you've got those pairs, we can delist.
Once we have four breeding pairs for three consecutive years.
Okay.
Yes.
How long did it take in Idaho to get to four? It sounds like they have a lot more than that now.
I'm not certain I can tell you the year that they had four pairs, but in a course of 10 years, you can visualize the graph going from a very small number that was originally released in central Idaho to 670-plus wolves. They've had, they documented 76 packs or breeding pairs this past year, so it didn't take them very long to get four breeding pairs, a few years actually.
So okay, so what I'm saying is if we don't take care of this year, then as soon as we'd be able, I guess we could take care of it, we're going to come back next year, so I guess it could happen. If we don't take care of it now, if they swim across the river and start here, they could be to those numbers in a fairly short period of time.
Yes, a matter of just a few years.
Okay.
At least to the first year of four breeding pairs, yes.
Okay. Yep. Hey, Mr. Chair, I don't want to go into it, but the members that weren't here last time, if you'd like to talk to us who were, we can explain breeding pairs, because two is not two.
It's a pack.
Somewhere between 14 and some nebulous number up there, about 60. It's breeding pairs. That means the first generation of breeding pairs.
I enjoyed the fact that they said packs, because I tend to think of them as four packs.
Not pair.
Yeah. And that's what they mean by green pairs. Any other questions?
Generation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some states it's 14 walls to make two. Some states it's 16 walls to make two.
They're still there. Okay, so we'll just go down the list, I guess. Is anybody over 100 miles?
There are some 100-mile people here.
Yeah, there are quite a few of them. In general, we take people who are more than 100 miles first, so we will
panel together.
Start with, is it Bill Moore and Mike Colton?
And Lee.
And Lee. I don't know Lee's last name. Come on up.
Representative Chair Roebling, committee members. My name is Bill Moore. I'm the president-elect of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association from the mountains of eastern Oregon. I ranch and live at Unity, Oregon, a small rural community between John Day and Ontario. Our organization represents the Oregon cattle industry, an industry that brings about $500 million annually to the bottom line of the state's economy. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. I appreciate the working relationship we've had with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. There's some issues there that we've worked diligently to try and resolve. Quite frankly, we still have some very strong concerns about the legislation as proposed. I want to start real briefly with a couple of quotes. The first, by Mr. Ed Banks, he's the head of wolf recovery for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service for the Northern Rocky Mountain Distinct Population. Mr. Banks has stated, habitat outside the Rocky Mountain Distinct Population, specifically Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, is marginally suitable at best and is insignificant to wolf population recovery because it occurs in small, isolated, fragmented areas. Therefore, we consider such areas as containing unsuitable habitat and that dispersing wolves attempting to colonize these areas are unlikely to significantly contribute to population recovery. The second quote is from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The diversity plan predicts, that there is no year-round habitat in Oregon that would allow wolves to exist without significant conflict with land uses already in place. Going further on, conflicts that have included livestock depredation, livestock harassment, and changes to deer and elk populations. We have proposed what we think is one small but significant amendment to this proposal that expands the take language under the state wildlife statute that expands that. Right now, it allows taking if a wolf actually has livestock in its jaws. The amendment that we're proposing just expands that take provision to include attacking, biting, molesting, chasing, harassing. Now, 80% by the Department of Fish and Wildlife statistics, 80% of the state's wildlife spend at least part of the year on private land. And just because of that fact alone, if you look at the maps that we've provided here in this two-page handout, there's some significant differences between the wolf establishment in Idaho and the distinct Rocky Mountain population as compared to the state of Oregon. Idaho has a very large, significant block of federal wilderness surrounded by federal roadless area that is one contiguous block. The conflicts that have recently arisen in Idaho have taken place as that wolf population has grown far beyond the the population estimates to the fringe area that interfaces with private land. Now, if you look at the map provided there of the state of Oregon, and this is actually off the Defenders of Wildlife website, the potential wolf recovery areas in Oregon, they've identified roughly 13,000 square miles in the state of Oregon that differs from the state of Idaho in that there are, by the federal biologist definition, small, isolated, fragmented pieces of federal land. And if you look on the map, it shows that those isolated pieces of federal land are interspersed with huge amounts of privately held land. Now, given that private-public interface and the fact that 80% of the wildlife in Oregon spend some time on private land, we have set ourselves up for significant conflicts. And the state and the feds acknowledged from the very start. Before wolves were introduced in Idaho, it was acknowledged that Oregon was going to be a home for significant conflicts when wolves came to Oregon. There again, if we were able to have our amendment that expands the take language, it does nothing to significantly impact wolf populations. In Idaho, with roughly 700 wolves right now, the take provision, the expanded take provision, that is exactly like this language that we've proposed here, has amounted to the death of, I think, 6 or 7 wolves, as compared to, at last count, I think, like 40 wolves that the feds have actually taken out because of livestock depredations or human safety concerns. So our language is not going to significantly impact the wolf population that reestablishes in Oregon. Now, by the Wolf Advocates survey, own survey, they maintain that 70% of the people in Oregon would like to have wolves recovered at some level. That same survey says of those 70% that want wolves, almost 90% of those people say that they don't want recovery to be on the back of ranchers. So we just feel that this amendment would allow us the ability to protect our private property without having any biological impact on the wolf population in Oregon. And if you look at, again, if you look at the habitat maps and the proposed population that Oregon and Idaho could support, in Idaho, there was roughly 30,000 square miles of suitable habitat in a contiguous block that was supposed to support 10 breeding pairs, roughly 100 wolves. We just heard that there's roughly 76 breeding pairs, somewhere close to 700 wolves in the state of Idaho. If you look at Oregon's population map, there's roughly 13,000 square miles of what people, advocates, call suitable habitat. Their estimate of what that area would support in Oregon, a third of what Idaho has, but they are proposing 1,450 wolves. It's the recipe for disaster. We think the state needs to have the ability to manage wolves when they come to Oregon. We think we need to have the ability to protect our private property when they come to Oregon. Thank you.
I'll just ask one question. Your amendment actually wouldn't even take place until after it was delisted, right?
I think, Representative Roblin, that nothing happens in Oregon until it's delisted. Nothing happens in Oregon until it's federally delisted.
Just wanted to make sure that point was made.
We just want our amendment to be included from the start, so when it's delisted, we have the ability to protect our private property.
Thank you. We'll go through and then we'll ask some questions.
Representative Roblin, committee members, my name is Mike Colton. I'm from Baker City, Oregon. I'm a cattle producer there. I'm also a past president of the Baker County Livestock Association, and I appreciate you taking the time to hear us out on this. This is something we've been involved with for a long time. There's been a lot of issues on the table, and hopefully we're here today to help straighten out a few small details to where we could all live with this. One of the things, this House Bill 2295, probably the biggest problem I see with it is it really does not allow producers to protect their livestock. And it basically doesn't allow them to do that under any circumstances. And the real problem is this language that says a livestock producer could kill a wolf in the act of attacking. I think probably some of you folks have heard from us on this issue. In some of my written testimony, I went into it in more depth. The fact of the matter is, it doesn't mean anything. I'll never see it. Nobody will ever see it. It's very clear that's the way it's going to work out. It doesn't mean anything. In House Bill 2295, you guys are looking at whether or not a permit should be required under those circumstances. Well, the first provision is a zero. The second provision is, so one times zero is zero, two times zero is zero. And I'll just leave it at that. Let's go back and look at where this language came from. The original act of attacking language actually came out of the federal plan. When the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife was putting together their plan, they tried to mirror what was then in fact called the 4D rules. This act of attacking was in the federal 4D rule language. As we went through the plan, there's a lot of things we weren't happy with. Many times we were told that they tried to be consistent with the federal plan, and that's where these language and some of these restrictions came from. Well, as you can see here, we have proposed some amendments that would broaden the scope of where a producer could protect his livestock, and that would be consistent with what would be the 10J rule, which is now what the federal law is. It looks to me like it would be a pretty simple step to continually mirror the federal rule and basically change this one small provision that would let somebody protect their livestock that was attacking, chasing, biting, or harassing. You know, this language has been in effect in Idaho for some time. Last year, we know that accounted for about a 1% kill rate of their wolves. I think Bill already said that, approximately 7 wolves. you have to kind of realize in the last 10 years of wolf introduction, the population has grown so wide, and this is in Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana. You know, wildlife officials themselves have had to kill in excess of 150 wolves in 2006. And, you know, it's kind of tough business. People want to be involved in predator recovery. They want to be involved in predator management. The problem is you have to kill some of them. And we all have to be willing to stomach that because that's part of the equation. And so we kind of look at some of these numbers and other things that have happened in the state. It doesn't make any sense to me that this government alienate landowners or ranchers by denying them a very simple right to protect their property. I know a lot of you folks probably were on the last year's committee and you were dealing with the cougar plan. And just draw a little parallel between the cougar management and wolf management, and we kind of know where this is heading. You know, in the cougar, you have a year-round season. We have an excess of 30,000 tag holders that are hunting them. Those provisions, you all know, have not worked to control the population. It has not been an effective management tool. This language that we're proposing here today is a very mild language. All it says is that wolves in the wrong areas doing the wrong things could be taken. You know, it still would be a very rare event. It would very seldom ever happen. But it would show some good will with the livestock producers and landowners of the state, which I think would be a good thing for this committee to do. I also think that it's important that we do address this active attacking language now. And one of the things, and if many of you haven't read the Oregon Wolf Conservation and Management Plan, it's kind of interesting to read through it. It's split into three different phases. In phase one, the only way you could kill a wolf was in the act of attacking. Well, in phase two, apparently that's when the delisting would begin, but the language still is in place. And then in the plan, we go to phase three. In phase three, we could have as many as 7 breeding pairs on each side of the state, and yet this language in the act of attacking is still there. And I would challenge you folks to possibly look that up. I've got some page numbers out of the December 2005 printing of the Wolf Conservation Management Plan. Those provisions, you can find that information on page 42, 43, and 44. One thing we would like to see, and it's mind-boggling to most Eastern Oregon ranchers, that the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and landowners, who we support a lot of wildlife, and how we've got on a different side of this issue. It doesn't make really much sense to any of us. And we need cooperation from them, and they need cooperation from us. And in Oregon, that's the only thing that's ever going to implement any wildlife plan. And I know that there's some folks in Oregon that would like to have ranchers tolerate some wolves. We may not be very excited about it. But there's only one way to really get some cooperation and tolerance, and that is you have to give us a little daylight. Just give us some tools. And that would be the best way to promote cooperation and tolerance, and give us a little chance to maybe do something about a wolf when he becomes intolerable, which we know he will. This amendment, I don't want anybody to get confused to think that this is going to be the end of wolf management. Before we're all done in the state of Oregon managing wolves, as a lot of you know, we're going to be into a much more aggressive management style to keep these predators under control. So we would certainly support the bill if we had those amendments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, committee members, my name is Leanne Skull, and I dress the way I did for a purpose. I don't look like the two cowboys next to me. I'm District 2 representative of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and I dress like 75 to 80% of the cattlemen in the United States, who own 50 or fewer head and supply you almost no meat. You just worked earlier in the session to help the small business people in Eugene and so forth. The small cattleman doesn't need any help because they're working somewhere else. I spent 28 years in higher ed in the state as a teacher and an administrator. I've been a cattleman in the state for 38 years. And what these people will tell you is the top 10% of the cattle people, not only in the state but in the United States, are providing 90% of your beef. They are the ones that are going to suffer from this bill the way that it is presently written. I was talking with our future president. If he rides horse all day, every day of the week, he may see most of his cattle. That's how many thousands of acres he's got to cover, and you're asking him to catch the wolf while it's got a hold of the animal? I mean, think about what you're talking about here. That's the way it is for the large cattleman in Eastern Oregon. This bill, in some ways, is going to be very difficult. They're your greatest supporters. They support the deer and the elk and the pheasant and the duck and all of that population on much of their private land. And you really need cooperation to make that work. And they're not asking for much. And I think really need to be supported. The take issue is one they didn't mention. My wife's uncle worked on a radio-collared survey of cattle in southeast Idaho out of Salmon. where they collared every one in five calves because they didn't have the money to do it. And they went, as soon as that collar didn't move for a period of time, they went and investigated because they knew a death had occurred. Wolves were primarily responsible for those deaths. It's right out of there. The results of restitution. We would like to see full and honest restitution. Defenders of Wildlife over the past, help me, I think it's been about 7 years, have paid $700,000 in restitution. If we understand the statistics, they should have paid $5.5 million. That would have been close to full restitution because you can't catch it. We've got that kind of surveys that have been done, and it's important to realize that that's the kind of thing that the major producers of your meat supply are having to deal with. And we need a wolf plan. We need to be able to move with the federal government. The plan that's now prepared for delisting would delist wolves in eastern Oregon. I think you know that. It would not delist wolves in western Oregon. And you will have to either face the future of transplanting them from eastern to western Oregon or bringing them down from Canada till we can have a state plan that reaches across. We could literally have 100 pair over there and none over here. And so I hope you'd take these things into consideration. We appreciate your time. And I'm sure these gentlemen and others can answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Chair. Just a brief answer, because I think cattlemen are very familiar with my position on compensation. I'm very sympathetic, but the challenge we face is that we compensate the wolf, we compensate the geese, we compensate the butterfly, we go down this entire road, and then for those of you who really want to open a can of worms, we can talk about Measure 37 compensation.
So let's not in that particular case, but what, I mean, can you just briefly comment on the compensation piece? Because that is problematic in my mind from a state policy position.
Chair Roblin, Representative Boquist, compensation for us is it's a difficult issue to get your hands around. And we don't actively go out and ask for compensation for all the antelope and deer and elk and everything else we support. And I can't sit here today and say that I'm really in favor of creating another bureaucracy that is only going to pay compensation on 12% to 15% of the actual loss. The Oregon cattleman's position, it's much more important to us to have the expanded take language than it is to have the compensation, and that's our policy.
I think I appreciate that. As Mr. Chair, as you know, I'd like to just issue him a Winchester, and that's the whole thing.
I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it did. Thank you very much. No other questions. Thanks for being here.
Thanks
for coming all that way. We went over to Baker City last time for our hearing on the wolf. We made that drive the other direction last time. We're still going down those more than 100 miles. Phyllis Wilson.
Chairman Roblin and other members of the committee, you're disappearing here on me.
They come and go.
You've helped me immensely. I do live more than 100 miles from here, but I currently only live about 5 blocks from here.
Oh, is that right?
So,
oh, okay.
My name is Phyllis Wilson, and I am the president of the Oregon State Grange, which has about 7,000 members in 200 communities in the state of Oregon. And my testimony is regarding the Wolf Management Bill, HB 2295. The Oregon State Grange policy states that it will oppose the reintroduction of any wolves into the state of Oregon. This policy was adopted in 1999, and since that time, we have continued and we will continue to oppose the reintroduction of wolves into the state. My organization has some concerns about HB 2295. Number one, HB 2295, Section 14.2, directs the ODF&W to, quote, seek out and receive any gifts, grants, donations, endowments, or requests for the purpose of paying compensation to persons who suffer loss or injury due to wolf depredation. Like all state agencies, the staff members are hard-pressed to keep up with their normal daily workload. The Oregon State Grange questions how the staff members will be able to add the task of fundraising to their already busy schedule. How qualified are the ODF&W staff members in soliciting money from the public? It does not seem reasonable or fair to staff members to be put into this position. Number two, the ODF&W faces budget concerns like all other state government agencies. From 1995 until 2001, the Idaho Fish and Wildlife Commission spent nearly $445,000 in just investigating reports of wolves in its state. The following information was obtained from a report compiled in 2002 from the University of Idaho titled Economic Impacts of Wolf Reintroduction. It was introduced at an integrated rangeland management class. On my written testimony, I have listed various items of the different investigations, some that were confirmed, some that were not confirmed, the animals involved ranging from calves to bulls to cows to sheep to one burro and one human being. I want to give you the totals that resulted from this investigation. There were 159 investigations, 60 confirmed reports of wolves, 441 animals involved, plus one human, for a total wildlife expenditures of $444,712. This information makes it very clear that livestock loss is real and documented. It has been nearly 5 years since this information was documented. How much have these numbers increased in the last several years? Our third concern. Wolves are not the only concerns of the state wildlife services. With all the time necessary to investigate complaints and seek funding for repayment programs, how will these agencies find time to perform their other tasks? It is doubtful that responses to wolf complaints can be investigated in a timely manner. Baker, Union, and Grant counties do not even have personnel from the USDA Wildlife Services, and this is from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife web page. And speaking of Baker County, just over a year ago, according to the Eugene Register Guard, the county commissioners were asked by the Baker County Water Master to have his assistants be allowed to carry pistols while working in remote areas because of his concerns that the assistant water masters are, quote, vulnerable to attack from predators while servicing head gates, measuring equipment, and gauging stations, unquote. Number four, our Oregon ranchers are a hardy force, but the numbers include elderly farmers and many female ranchers. How easily could they defend themselves in a life-threatening situation? Number five, there absolutely must be an amendment to HB 2295, allowing Oregon livestock producers to take a gray wolf without a permit if the wolf is, and it should say attacking, not attaching. They should be able to take a gray wolf without a permit if the wolf is attacking, biting, molesting, chasing, or harassing. OAR 635-110-00110-5A requires that lethal taking of wolves in the act of attacking domestic animals must be done so with a permit from the ODF&W. I hardly think a wolf can be put on attack on hold while the rancher drives to town to obtain a permit. Number six, HB 2295 must also include an amendment that aligns with the Federal Endangered Species Act so that immediately upon gray wolf delisting at the federal level, those affected in Oregon can act accordingly. In closing, please do not even allow the reintroduction of wolves in the state of Oregon because of the danger they pose. This will make life much simpler and safer for our ranchers and citizens.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this witness? Thank you. Next we have, looks like Ben Boswell, Lowell County.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. I'm Ben Boswell, a resident of 409 Wallow Avenue in Lostine. I've been actively engaged in the wolf issue since 1988 when I wrote the first wolf policy for the Oregon State Range. I'm a Wallow County Commissioner who served on the Oregon Wolf Advisory Committee as the representative of Eastern Oregon County Commissioners. As the immediate president of the Association of Oregon Counties, I'm here today to not only represent the interests of the residents and visitors of Wallow County, but the interests of the association as well. Although the Oregon Wolf Conservation and Management Plan was to have been the result of a consensual process, I was compelled to file a minority report when I could not consent to all elements of the plan. Since my report has been purged from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife webpage, I've provided a copy for your convenience. I continue to believe that the effort to conserve wolves is a fool's errand, and I urge zero tolerance for wolves in Oregon. If wolf populations increase, lots of wildlife will die, some livestock will die, and many wolves will die. That's not fair to the wolves. They're just doing what they do. Wolves are so smart and adaptable that prevention of loss measures do not work. Why would we permit such a threat to invade our communities, allowing loss to occur in exchange for compensation? The chance of peaceful coexistence is slim. Carter Niemeyer, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Idaho Wolf Recovery Coordinator, has said, "We have attempted to use many preventive measures. Non-lethal means of control did not deter the wolf's persistent livestock depredation. The reality is that chronic depredation incidents may result in the lethal control of some gray wolves in Idaho." And in fact, in Idaho, according to the numbers I have, in 2005, there were documented 97 cattle kills by wolves, 244 sheep, 11 horses, and 2 dogs. Wolf management officials killed 103 wolves. This in spite of having substantial amounts of suitable habitat in wilderness areas. I believe, as Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife policy said and had been for decades until 2002, that Oregon does not have suitable or sufficient habitat for wolves without serious conflicts. My overall suggestion is to legislatively unlist, not delist, the wolf from Oregon's endangered species list. I believe that if people could control threats to their domestic animals, the animals would survive and wolves would survive. My specific objections to the legislation are as follows. It does not include adequate take provisions for wolves threatening domestic animals. I propose that any person may take any wolf at any time when caught in the act of harassing or attacking any person or domestic animal. It does not include management objectives that are based on measurable effects of wolves on people and other animals. I propose developing a management matrix which includes all the measures I have identified in the Wolf Index I have provided. It does not provide for adequate or equitable funding for the management of wolves by wildlife services. See the spreadsheet to find that the state's share of support for wildlife services is not fair and adequate. See the enclosed map to see that not all counties contribute to wildlife services. I propose that general fund revenues be dedicated to at least double the support from the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. It does not provide for expeditious compensation program. I propose that the advisory committee provisions of Section 15 be eliminated and a system of compensation similar to the federal crop insurance program be designated and implemented with federal money. In conclusion, Section 1.3 of the bill defines compatible as, quote, capable of existing in harmony so as to minimize conflict, close quote. I believe that you have an impossible mission as you consider how this legislation may minimize conflict by finding harmony.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you. I think that takes care of all the people who traveled over. Oh, no, we don't. Katie Fast and Peggy Brown. So Peggy must be a little farther than. Go ahead and say Katie isn't.
Chair Roble and members of the committee, once again, Katie Fast with Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Peggy Brown is the president of Baker County Farm Bureau. I'd like to turn it over to her, and then I'll do the wrap-up.
Chair Roble and members of the committee, thank you for the time that you're giving us today here. You know, it's kind of funny. I fall into two categories they've talked about here so far today. One is we have a herd that... Oh, I'm sorry. Peggy Brown from actually Union County, and I'm Baker County Farm Bureau President, and I live near North Powder, Oregon. Anyway, back to the two categories. We have a small herd under the 50 mother cow mark, and also female ranchers. So there's your two categories that they've talked about today. And I'll tell you that with that small herd, we can use any help that you give us. So, but it does magnify, multiple times for the help that we need to give the large ranchers because they can't see all their cattle and can't watch them as closely. So let me paint you a small picture of what we have to deal with my small herd. We live at the foothills, not up in the mountains, down in a valley, and not so long ago had an issue with something getting into our herd and chasing them, and a steer was lost. And this was a large steer. You know, he was ready to butcher, probably about 1,200 pounds. Luckily, he wasn't my son's 4-H steer because that would have been far more catastrophic, as you can imagine. But all in all, we finally figured out that it was probably a pair of pit bulls that were wandering around. But what do we do? You know, do you try to figure out who owned them and take them to court and spend $5,000-$10,000 to recover $1,500? No, that doesn't work. It happened in the middle of the night, so we can't say for sure it was them. It's just the bizarre circumstances, the trampled fences, and the manner and the way the steer died and where he died that we really believe and evidence points to how this happened. So the point in my story is that even though there are laws to currently keep things from happening like happened to us, it's not enough. And with the new exotic animal that's being reintroduced to our state, it's going to make this 10 times worse. How am I supposed to take care of our livelihood when I see something like this happening and can't shoot them? I have to wait. I have to go to town. I have to get a permit. It's not going to happen. There's going to be no time to go take care of our livestock. And I'm going to lose money exponentially, not just $1,200 for one steer. We have compromised on this plan. Our gut has told us from the get-go that we didn't want wolves at all, but we realized that, you know, this is going to happen whether we like it or not. And so we're not blowing our backs anymore. Our constituents, my constituents came to me and said, Peggy, we need you to go down there and testify. We need you to go down there and let them know what we're facing, that we need their help, and to implore them to put into this plan that we can protect our livestock in the event that a wolf is chasing or harassing them. So I'm telling you right now that we begrudgingly support this bill as it is, but with the cattlemen's suggested amendments, would support it in a much happier manner. Thank you.
Thank you.
Once again, for the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau support of 2295 comes in a unique situation where the state ESA protects a species that's a predator, but it doesn't offer flexibility to the livestock industry to defend and protect its livelihood. Last session, Oregon Farm Bureau reached at the request of the Defenders of Wildlife, went into negotiations with Defenders, Hell's Canyon, the Hunters Association, and the Sheep Growers, and reached agreement upon what was defined then as the Dash 5 amendments. And 2295 is the Dash 5 in most parts from last session. Currently, we're in a situation where the federal government is looking at delisting the wolf, and they've started public comments throughout the West on the gray wolf. As this delisting process happens, which will be a slow process, we recognize, Oregon ranchers are going to be left with no options to protect their livestock from being attacked. When we look at House Bill 2295, the most controversial piece of it is the take provisions and the language caught in the act of attacking. Oregon Farm Bureau has supported that being kept in the bill with the option of compensation for livestock. The compensation piece does give some ability to recover losses. We recognize that that will not be 100% recovery. It will probably be a partial recovery of the losses that the livestock industry will receive from having wolves in the state. We would much rather have the cattleman's amendment put in the bill. However, we recognize that there are maybe political challenges to having that added to the bill, and we agreed last session to the concepts that are in 2295, and we retain that support this session. I just like to close that when you look at compensation, and I know that's controversial for members of the committee, for us, we see this as not a typical species, but one that has unique government regulations and government actions that have reinduced it to Oregon and are putting the livestock industry in the situation they're in now. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you very
much. Thank you.
I'll mention it at the end. I was just going to say thank you. That takes care of everybody that was over 100 miles. Al Elkins and Dave Wiley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau talked about the meeting that was held last year and the work group that was put together, and the result of which is the Dash 5 amendments and the House bill that you have before you. We support this House bill. Mr. Wiley and I were on that work committee, and Mr. Wiley is going to give a summary of why this bill is important to us.
Representative Roland, members of the committee, I'm Dave Wiley. I live out in Sublimity. Yes, I was there. I'd like to say at the outset that we'd like you to pass this bill out with a due pass. Now, I'm a native Oregonian. I'm both a hunter and a fisherman. I view myself as a hunter conservationist. And I, too, am involved in livestock. My brother and I up on Salvage Island. I doubt whether a wolf will ever get there. But we have about 35 head of mother cows, and so I have an affinity as well for the livestock interest position. Now, we got into quite a contest, the Oregon Hunters Association, and
We didn't think we got a square shake before the commission, so we met them at the legislature last go-around. And we proposed some changes to some wording, and we ended up, as Katie Kraft said, in some closed-door negotiations with the environmentalists. And the outshot of this is what you see before you, the Dash 5 amendments. Now, this is a compromise, and, you know, I'm here to tell you that the sportsmen would probably not like to have wolves in the state of Oregon if we could avoid it. But there's two laws that require the state to act as it does, the Federal Endangered Species Act and the State Endangered Species Act. And we ended up with a plan. This bill tweaks the plan just a little bit, provides some things that allow people to protect private property. This bill provides for the game animal classification. It's got a compensation issue in there, and we think it's a good political compromise. I'd like to stress that from a sportsman's standpoint, that the issue about game mammal doesn't have a lot of effect at the outset. That's because the Federal and State Endangered Species Act provide plenty, a whole lot more stringent management constraints than some of us think are necessary. But after the wolf is delisted, if we don't have it classified as a game mammal, and it were to stay as it is now, a protected non-game wildlife, that the ability of the commission and its department to manage the wolf would be severely constrained. And we think that this is a better classification for the animal. So in closing, just let me say that it's very likely the wolves are here. You heard the fellows from ODF and W. And it's also highly likely that those animals are going to propagate at a great rate, as the experience has shown that they do in Idaho. And let me tell you, Oregon ain't Idaho. It isn't Wyoming. Our geographic distribution, our social economic demographics are not Idaho. We are going to have big-time problems. And so in closing, I'd sure like to see you pass this bill out. And if you don't, Oregon's going to be left with a wolf management situation that is far more restrictive than the federal laws. Thank you. Answer any questions you got.
Thank you very much. I think we're okay. Thanks. Arlene Kovash? Either way.
I am Arlene Kovash, and I'm from Oregon Women for Agriculture, and we're also livestock producers. And I have come in support of the Cattlemen's Amendment, asking that Well, I'm going to read my testimony because when I get in front of a group like this, I tend to leave my brain sitting in the seat back there. So I just want to say at the beginning that I think it was a very foolish thing to have declared the wolves endangered. It's like because I don't have any rats in my house, that if one gets in, it should be declared endangered, and I shouldn't be able to take it. It's not going to happen. I'm alive. I'm growing food, which is necessary for life itself. And this isn't a choice for people to say, okay, I'm going to either grow food or play golf. We need food. And I'm asking that your committee do as much as possible to keep producers in business while protecting wildlife by injecting some common sense into this bill by passing this amendment that the cattlemen have proposed was our coming at the insistence of those who have no part in the process of providing our abundant, healthy food for everyone. And so one way you can help us is to make it possible for us to protect our animals. Isn't it wrong to stand by when a little calf or lamb is being eaten alive? At that point, it's too late to run for a permit. We must be able to not only take the wolf if it is attacking or biting our animals, but if they are beginning to molest, chase, or harass them, and get them in time before they do damage the animals. And this is good for both the sake of our livestock and the actual wolf that is trying to harm the animal. If we have to run for a permit, who knows what wolf we're getting, maybe not the one that's actually doing the harassing. And I also feel that by being able to get these animals that are bothering our livestock, that we're going to actually be saving on compensation, because we'll be able to get them before anything happens. And it will probably greatly reduce the compensation that needs to be paid out. We as livestock producers have had to acquiesce to every group that demands that we save every wild animals at the expense of our useful animals. And so we just really want you to look at this amendment with a clear eye and include it to protect both those wild animals and our domestic animals. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Thanks. Any questions? No. Thank you very much. And our last person on the list is Laurel Hines.
Representative Roland and committee members. I've learned to say that now because I've heard everybody else saying that.
Yeah.
I am against this bill. I think that wolves are an intelligent and revered.
Need to remind you.
Oh, okay, Laurel Hines.
Thank you.
And I just represent myself. I think that wolves are an important part of the ecosystem and revered animals. And I think I just found out about this bill because I'm getting the announcements of the committees by email. And I think that most people in the general public that I've talked to know nothing about this bill except the cattlemen and the ranchers and the hunting people. And I think if the general public knew about this bill, I'm pretty sure that most of them would be opposed to it. Especially if it allows cruelty methods like trapping and poisoning wolves, because I think the general public twice has voted against, as you know, cougar trapping and hunting by dogs and very cruel methods of killing large predator animals. And I think they would even be more opposed to such killing of wolves because of the fact that wolves are highly revered. People go up to Wolf Haven up in Washington, and there's now a place somewhere in southern Oregon where people go to see wolves, and wolves are highly loved. And I think there's ways that we can live with wolves in Oregon by compensating ranchers and by teaching ranchers how to protect their animals. And general livestock are not endangered the way wolves are. And I think we'll be lucky to get them back here if we can get them back. And I think it would be wrong to call them a game animal. They're not the same as deer or other game animals like that. Wolves were already wiped out of Oregon by hunters and ranchers. And I attended many of the wolf hearings and testified at them. And I know that ranchers are eager to kill wolves and probably would do it without the wolves actually chasing or harassing their animals. I've seen it happen out where I live just with coyotes. Many ranchers make sure that they get trapped or shoot at anything that looks like a coyote, whether they actually have killed any of their animals or not. Study after study has been showing in the last couple of years how large predator animals, including wolves and cougars, are essential to a healthy ecosystem. There's a study just done by Oregon State University and Zion National Park that showed that in several areas that where the ecosystems were declining, down to the level of fish, salmon and other fish, and rare species of fish, that when wolves were reinstated in one section and were avoiding the section where there were a lot of tourists, the sections where the wolves were reinstating themselves, the ecosystems began to repair from down from the willows along the creeks and the rivers to the larger trees and to the frogs and down to the fish. Even salmon were returning to areas where they had been decimated. So the ecosystems are dependent on large predators. And I think there's been other studies, I think it was in Yellowstone and other areas where they thought wolves were going to be a problem, and when they were reinstated, they actually helped the ecosystem. So I think it would be wrong to allow ranchers and other people opposed to wolves to more easily shoot them without proving that their livestock is being killed by them. I think given half a chance, they would do that. I also think from all the things that I've read about wolves that just like was testified at the cougar hearing the other day, that when the larger, more intelligent, and more senior alpha wolves are killed off, the younger ones that are not as social, highly socialized and aren't as controlled by the alpha wolves are going to be the ones most likely to go out and kill easy prey like domestic animals instead of their normal prey. So I think upsetting the whole wolf pack system is going to increase the problem. And I think that a lot of these decisions should be based on science and not just on hatred or fear of wolves, because our ecosystems are dependent on it, the future is dependent on it, and I think it's a mistake to allow more killing to be more easily done and not without a permit. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. So you have two letters in your folders. One is from the Defenders of Wildlife who oppose this bill, and you can read that one. And the other one is from Oregon Wild, also in opposition. Before we end the hearing, I just want to say I appreciate Fish and Wildlife. This session, I asked at the beginning of the year, they asked for a hearing on this bill because it's what the commission is looking at, trying to implement their stuff. I asked them to work with groups to see if they could come to an agreement. We started with the last year's Dash Fives. They came together a number of times with some of the stakeholders. And in the end, Vice Chair Smith and I sat with a group of the people seeing if we could find some bill that everybody could agree on. We did not get there. There were more people who agreed with this bill last session than there probably are now, because defenders at one time were in favor of this bill. I want to commend the department for continuing to work on this. I think it's a very important issue. I will talk with the members as time goes on to find out, you know, what we want to do and how we want to deal with this bill. I am personally very concerned about the reintroduction of wolves. I told people last time when I was on here that the wolf history in the United States and interactions with people has been a very, very sad and interesting history if we look back. It has never been a positive one. People will talk about it a lot of times with nostalgia about wolves, but it has not been a good interaction. And the more we put cities and other places in these places and divide up your property, the less likely it is that wolves will have, I think, a real positive effect on reintroduction. But that's not a choice. We have a federal mandate with the Endangered Species Act, so we've got to deal with it. And we need to find that thing that will work, and I believe the commission, everybody worked hard to try to get there. We are not there yet, and I will talk with each of the members and see if we can find something, because in the final analysis, whatever we have to come to has to get through this whole process, and if not, then we will end up remaining under the Federal Endangered Species Act and then under the Oregon Endangered Species Act. We may be able to continue like we did last time, not doing anything this time, and moving for another 2 years. But there will come a time when we're going to have to do something. And that frustrates me a lot. So I hope that if you can think of any other ideas, if you can think of things, we'll think about this bill. And I guess we'll leave it at that, unless anybody else wants to say, make a comment or two about the whole thing. But I have talked to most of you about these bills on our committee, and I'm not feeling a real consensus amongst the group about where we should go with that amendment. So I will continue to talk to you, and I commend the department for trying to figure out a way through this whole issue. And I'm one of those people who wish that we weren't dealing with this issue, because we didn't have to deal with wolves. But, and I think there are plenty of wolves on this planet. There are a lot of them. So with that,
shall we go take on Measure 37 now, Mr.
That'll
Chair?
That'll be our next one. Yeah,
that's okay.
4 minutes. So I'm going to close this, the hearing on House Bill 2295, and we will close our session on Ag and Natural Resources.
Thank you.